Dr. No by Ian Fleming. Copyright 1958 by Glidrose Productions Limited. Copyright renewed 1986. This unabridged recording of the reading of Dr. No was published by arrangement with Ian Fleming, Glidrose Publications Limited, and was produced in 2000 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Robert Whitfield. This book is 189 pages long. Dr. No by Ian Fleming. The following material appears on the book's back cover. M called this case a soft option. Bond can't quite agree. The tropical island is luxurious, the seductive Honey Rider is beautiful and willing, but they are both part of the empire of Dr. No. The doctor is a worthy adversary, with a mind as hard and cold as his solid steel hands. Dr. No's obsession is power. His only gifts are strictly pain-shaped. The essence of a James Bond thriller is its speed, its knowingness. Dr. No has a full quota of every ingredient. Bond is better than ever. Evening Standard. Masterful. Beautifully written. Raymond Chandler, The Sunday Times. Chapter 1. Hear You Loud and Clear. Punctually at 6 o'clock, the sun set with a last yellow flash behind the blue mountains, a wave of violet shadow poured down Richmond Road, and the crickets and tree frogs in the fine gardens began to zing and tinkle. Apart from the background noise of the insects, the wide, empty street was quiet. The wealthy owners of the big, withdrawn houses, the bank managers, company directors, and top civil servants, had been home since 5 o'clock, and they would be discussing the day with their wives, or taking a shower and changing their clothes. In half an hour the street would come to life again with the cocktail traffic, but now this very superior half-mile of Rich Road, as it was known to the tradesmen of Kingston, held nothing but the suspense of an empty stage, and the heavy perfume of night-scented jasmine. Richmond Road is the best road in all Jamaica. It is Jamaica's Park Avenue, its Kensington Palace Gardens, its Avenue Diana. The best people live in its big, old-fashioned houses, each in an acre or two of beautiful lawn set too trimly with the finest trees and flowers from the botanical gardens at Hope. The long, straight road is cool and quiet and withdrawn from the hot, vulgar sprawl of Kingston, where its residents earn their money, and on the other side of the T-intersection at its top lie the grounds of King's House, where the governor and commander-in-chief of Jamaica lives with his family. In Jamaica, no road could have a finer ending. On the eastern corner of the top intersection stands No. 1 Richmond Road, a substantial two-story house with broad white-painted verandas running round both floors. From the road, a gravel path leads up to the pillared entrance, through wide lawns marked out with tennis courts, on which this evening, as on all evenings, the sprinklers are at work. This mansion is the social mecca of Kingston. It is Queen's Club, which, for 50 years, has boasted the power and frequency of its blackballs. Such stubborn retreats will not long survive in modern Jamaica. One day, Queen's Club will have its windows smashed and perhaps be burned to the ground, but for the time being it is a useful place to find in a subtropical island, well run, well staffed, and with the finest cuisine and cellar in the Caribbean. At that time of day, on most evenings of the year, you would find the same 4 motor cars standing in the road outside the club. They were the cars belonging to the high bridge game that assembled punctually at 5 and played until around midnight. You could almost set your watch by these cars. They belonged, reading from the order in which they now stood against the curb, to the brigadier in command of the Caribbean Defence Force, to Kingston's leading criminal lawyer, and to the mathematics professor from Kingston University. At the tail of the line stood the black Sunbeam Alpine of Commander John Strangways, RN retired, regional control officer for the Caribbean, or, less discreetly, the local representative of the British Secret Service. Just before 6:15, the silence of Richmond Road was softly broken. Three blind beggars came round the corner of the intersection and moved slowly down the pavement towards the four cars. They were Chigros, Chinese Negroes, bulky men, but bowed as they shuffled along, tapping at the curb with their white sticks. They walked in file. The first man, who wore blue glasses and could presumably see better than the others, walked in front, holding a tin cup against the crook of the stick in his left hand. The right hand of the second man rested on his shoulder, and the right hand of the third on the shoulder of the second. The eyes of the second and third men were shut. The three men were dressed in rags and wore dirty jipper-japper baseball caps with long peaks. They said nothing, and no noise came from them, except the soft tapping of their sticks as they came slowly down the shadowed pavement towards the group of cars. The three blind men would not have been incongruous in Kingston, where there are many diseased people on the streets, but in this quiet, rich, empty street they made an unpleasant impression, and it was odd that they should all be Chinese Negroes. This is not a common mixture of bloods. In the card room, the sunburned hand reached out into the green pool of the centre table and gathered up the four cards. There was a quiet snap as the trick went to join the rest.
100 honours, said Strangways, and 90 below.
He looked at his watch and stood up.
Back in 20 minutes. Your deal, Bill. Order some drinks. Usual for me.
Don't bother to cook a hand for me while I'm gone. I always spot them.
Bill Templer, the brigadier, laughed shortly. He pinged the bell by his side and raked the cards in towards him. He said,
"Hurry up, blast you! You always let the cards go cold, just as your partner's in the money."
Strangways was already out of the door. The three men sat back resignedly in their chairs. The coloured steward came in, and they ordered drinks for themselves and a whisky and water for Strangways. There was this maddening interruption every evening at 6:15, about halfway through their second rubber. At this time, precisely, even if they were in the middle of a hand, Strangways had to go to his office and make a call. It was a damned nuisance, but Strangways was a vital part of their four, and they put up with it. It was never explained what the call was, and no one asked. Strangways's job was hush, and that was that. He was rarely away for more than 20 minutes, and it was understood that he paid for his absence with a round of drinks. The drinks came, and the three men began to talk racing. In fact, this was the most important moment in Strangways's day, the time of his duty radio contact with the powerful transmitter on the roof of the building in Regent's Park that is the headquarters of the Secret Service. Every day at 18:30 local time, unless he gave warning the day before that he would not be on the air, when he had business on one of the other islands in his territory, for instance, or was seriously ill, he would transmit his daily report and receive his orders. If he failed to come on the air precisely at 6:30, there would be a second call, the blue call at 7, and finally the red call at 7:30. After this, if his transmitter remained silent, it was emergency, and Section 3, his controlling authority in London, would urgently get on the job of finding out what had happened to him. Even a blue call means a bad mark for an agent, unless his reasons in writing are unanswerable. London's radio schedules round the world are desperately tight, and their minute disruption by even one extra call is a dangerous nuisance. Strangways had never suffered the ignominy of a blue call, let alone a red, and was as certain as he could be that he never would do so. Every evening at precisely 6:15, he left Queen's Club, got into his car, and drove for 10 minutes up into the foothills of the Blue Mountains to his neat bungalow with the fabulous view over Kingston Harbour. At 6:25, he walked through the hall to the office at the back. He unlocked the door and locked it again behind him. Miss Trueblood, who passed as his secretary, but was in fact his number two and a former chief officer WRNS, would already be sitting in front of the dials inside the dummy filing cabinet. She would have the earphones on and would be making first contact, tapping out his call sign, WXN, on 14 megacycles. There would be a shorthand pad on her elegant knees. Strangways would drop into the chair beside her and pick up the other pair of headphones, and, at exactly 6:28, he would take over from her and wait for the sudden hollowness in the ether that meant that WWW in London was coming in to acknowledge. It was an iron routine. Strangways was a man of iron routine. Unfortunately, strict patterns of behaviour can be deadly if they are read by an enemy. Strangways, a tall, lean man with a black patch over the right eye and the sort of aquiline good looks you associate with the bridge of a destroyer, walked quickly across the mahogany-panelled hallway of Queen's Club and pushed through the light mosquito-wired doors and ran down the three steps to the path. There was nothing very much on his mind, except the sensual pleasure of the clean, fresh evening air and the memory of the finesse that had given him his three spades. There was this case, of course, the case he was working on, a curious and complicated affair that M had rather nonchalantly tossed over the air at him 2 weeks earlier. But it was going well. A chance lead into the Chinese community had paid off. Some odd angles had come to light, for the present the merest shadows of angles. But if they gelled, thought Strangways, as he strode down the gravel path and into Richmond Road, he might find himself involved in something very odd indeed. Strangways shrugged his shoulders. Of course it wouldn't turn out like that. The fantastic never materialized in his line of business. There would be some drab solution that had been embroidered by overheated imaginations and the usual hysteria of the Chinese. Automatically, another part of Strangways's mind took in the three blind men. They were tapping slowly towards him down the sidewalk. They were about 20 yards away. He calculated that they would pass him a second or two before he reached his car. Out of shame for his own health and gratitude for it, Strangways felt for a coin. He ran his thumbnail down its edge to make sure it was a florin and not a penny. He took it out. He was parallel with the beggars. How odd! They were all chigros. How very odd! Strangways's hand went out. The coin clanged in the tin cup.
"Bless you, master," said the leading man.
"Bless you,"
echoed the other two. The car key was in Strangways's hand. Vaguely he registered the moment of silence as the tapping of the white sticks ceased. It was too late. As Strangways had passed the last man, all three had swiveled. The back two had fanned out a step to have a clear field of fire. Three revolvers, ungainly with their sausage-shaped silencers, whipped out of holsters concealed among the rags. With disciplined precision the three men aimed at different points down Strangways's spine, one between the shoulders, one in the small of the back, one at the pelvis. The three heavy coughs were almost one. Strangway's body was hurled forward as if it had been kicked. It lay absolutely still in the small puff of dust from the sidewalk. It was 6:17. With a squeal of tires, a dingy motor hearse with black plumes flying from the four corners of its roof took the T-intersection into Richmond Road and shot down towards the group on the pavement. The three men had just had time to pick up Strangways's body when the hearse slid to a stop abreast of them. The double doors at the back were open, so was the plain deal coffin inside. The three men manhandled the body through the doors and into the coffin. They climbed in. The lid was put on and the doors pulled shut. The three negroes sat down on three of the four little seats at the corners of the coffin and unhurriedly laid their white sticks beside them. Roomy black alpaca coats hung over the backs of the seats. They put the coats on over their rags. Then they took off their baseball caps and reached down to the floor and picked up black top hats and put them on their heads. The driver, who also was a Chinese negro, looked nervously over his shoulder.
"Go, man, go!"
said the biggest of the killers. He glanced down at the luminous dial of his wristwatch. It said 6:20. Just 3 minutes for the job. Dead on time. The hearse made a decorous U-turn and moved at a sedate speed up to the intersection. There it turned right, and at 30 miles an hour it cruised genteelly up the tarmac highway towards the hills, its black plumes streaming the doleful signal of its burden, and the three mourners sitting bolt upright with their arms crossed respectfully over their hearts.
WXN calling, WWW. WXN calling, WWW. WXN, WXN. WXN.
The centre finger of Mary Trueblood's right hand stabbed softly, elegantly at the key. She lifted her left wrist. 6:28. He was a minute late. Mary Trueblood smiled at the thought of the little open sunbeam tearing up the road towards her. Now, in a second, she would hear the quick step, then the key and the lock, and he would be sitting beside her. There would be the apologetic smile as he reached for the earphones.
"Sorry, Mary. Damned car wouldn't start."
Or,
"You'd think the blasted police knew my number by now. Stopped me at halfway tree."
Mary Trueblood took the second pair of earphones off their hook and put them on his chair to save him half a second.
WXN calling WWW. WXN calling WWW.
She tuned the dial a hair's breadth and tried again. Her watch said 6:29. She began to worry. In a matter of seconds, London would be coming in. Suddenly, she thought, God, what could she do if Strangways wasn't on time? It was useless for her to acknowledge London and pretend she was him. Useless and dangerous. Radio security would be monitoring the call as they monitored every call from an agent. Those instruments which measured the minute peculiarities in an operator's fist would at once detect it wasn't Strangways at the key. Mary Trueblood had been shown the forest of dials in the quiet room on the top floor at headquarters, had watched as the dancing hands registered the weight of each pulse, the speed of each cipher group, the stumble over a particular letter. The controller had explained it all to her when she had joined the Caribbean station 5 years before, how a buzzer would sound and the contact be automatically broken if the wrong operator had come on the air. It was the basic protection against a Secret Service transmitter falling into enemy hands. And if an agent had been captured and was being forced to contact London under torture, he had only to add a few hair-breadth peculiarities to his usual fist, and they would tell the story of his capture as clearly as if he had announced it en clair. Now it had come. Now she was hearing the hollowness in the ether that meant London was coming in. Mary Trueblood glanced at her watch. 6:30. Panic. But now, at last, there were the footsteps in the hall. Thank God. In a second he would come in. She must protect him. Desperately she decided to take a chance and keep the circuit open. WWW calling WXN. WWW calling WXN. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? London was coming over strong, searching for the Jamaica station. The footsteps were at the door. Coolly, confidently, she tapped back. Hear you loud and clear. Hear you loud and clear. Hear you... Behind her there was an explosion. Something hit her on the ankle. She looked down. It was the lock of the door. Mary Trueblood swiveled sharply on her chair. A man stood in the doorway. It wasn't Strangways. It was a big negro with yellowish skin and slanting eyes. There was a gun in his hand. It ended in a thick black cylinder. Mary Trueblood opened her mouth to scream. The man smiled broadly. Slowly, lovingly, he lifted the gun and shot her 3 times in and around the left breast. The girl slumped sideways off her chair. The earphones slipped off her golden hair onto the floor. For perhaps a second, the tiny chirrup of London sounded out into the room. Then it stopped. The buzzer at the controller's desk in radio security had signalled that something was wrong on WXN. The killer walked out of the door. He came back carrying a box with a coloured label on it that said Presto Fire, and a big sugar sack marked Tate and Lyle. He put the box down on the floor and went to the body and roughly forced the sack over the head and down to the ankles. The feet stuck out. He bent them and crammed them in. He dragged the bulky sack out into the hall and came back. In the corner of the room the safe stood open, as he had been told it would, and the cipher books had been taken out and laid on the desk, ready for work on the London signals. The man threw these and all the papers in the safe into the centre of the room. He tore down the curtains and added them to the pile. He topped it up with a couple of chairs. He opened the box of Presto firelighters and took out a handful and tucked them into the pile and lit them. Then he went out into the hall and lit similar bonfires in appropriate places. The tinder-dry furniture caught quickly, and the flames began to lick up the panelling. The man went to the front door and opened it. Through the hibiscus hedge he could see the glint of the hearse. There was no noise except the zing of crickets and the soft tick-over of the car's engine. Up and down the road there was no other sign of life. The man went back into the smoke-filled hall and easily shouldered the sack and came out again, leaving the door open to make a draught. He walked swiftly down the path to the road. The back doors of the hearse were open. He handed in the sack and watched the 2 men force it into the coffin on top of Strangways's body. Then he climbed in and shut the doors and sat down and put on his top hat. As the first flames showed in the upper windows of the bungalow, the hearse moved quietly from the sidewalk and went on its way up towards the Mona Reservoir. There the weighted coffin would slip down into its 50-fathom grave, and in just 45 minutes the personnel and records of the Caribbean station of the Secret Service would have been utterly destroyed. Chapter 2. Choice of Weapons. 3 weeks later, in London, March came in like a rattlesnake. From first light on March the 1st, hail and icy sleet, with a force-8 gale behind them, lashed at the city and went on lashing as the people streamed miserably to work, their legs whipped by the wet hems of their mackintoshes, and their faces blotching with the cold. It was a filthy day, and everybody said so, even M, who rarely admitted the existence of weather, even in its extreme forms. When the old black silver Wraith Rolls with a nondescript number plate stopped outside the tall building in Regent's Park, and he climbed stiffly out onto the pavement, hail hit him in the face like a whiff of small shot. Instead of hurrying inside the building, he walked deliberately round the car to the window beside the chauffeur.
"Won't be needing the car again today, Smith. Take it away and go home. I'll use the tube this evening. No weather for driving a car. Worse than one of those PQ convoys."
Ex-leading stoker Smith grinned gratefully.
"Aye, aye, sir, and thanks."
He watched the elderly, erect figure walk round the bonnet of the Rolls and across the pavement and into the building. Just like the old boy. He'd always see the men right first. Smith clicked the gear lever into first and moved off, peering forward through the streaming windscreen. They didn't come like that any more. M went up in the lift to the 8th floor and along the thick carpeted corridor to his office. He shut the door behind him, took off his overcoat and scarf, and hung them behind the door. He took out a large blue silk bandana handkerchief and brusquely wiped it over his face. It was odd, but he wouldn't have done this in front of the porters or the lift man. He went over to his desk and sat down and bent towards the intercom. He pressed a switch.
"I'm in, Miss Moneypenny. The signals, please, and anything else you've got. Then get Mr. James Maloney. He'll be doing his rounds at St. Mary's about now. Tell the Chief of Staff I'll see 007 in half an hour, and let me have the Strangways file."
M waited for the metallic, "Yes, sir," and released the switch. He sat back and reached for his pipe and began filling it thoughtfully. He didn't look up when his secretary came in with a stack of papers, and he even ignored the half-dozen pink most immediates on top of the signal file. If they had been vital, he would have been called during the night. A yellow light winked on the intercom. M picked up the black telephone from the row of four.
"That you, Sir James? Have you got 5 minutes?"
Six for you."
At the other end of the line, the famous neurologist chuckled.
"Want me to certify one of Her Majesty's ministers?"
"Not today."
M frowned irritably. The old Navy had respected governments.
"It's about that man of mine you've been handling. We won't bother about the name. This is an open line. I gather you let him out yesterday. Is he fit for duty?"
There was a pause on the other end. Now the voice was professional, judicious.
"Physically, he's as fit as a fiddle. Legs healed up. Shouldn't be any after effects. Yes, he's all right."
There was another pause.
"Just one thing, Em. There's a lot of tension there, you know. You work these men of yours pretty hard. Can you give him something easy to start with? From what you've told me, he's been having a tough time for some years now."
Em said gruffly,
"That's what he's paid for. It'll soon show if he's not up to the work. Won't be the first one that's cracked. From what you say, he sounds in perfectly good shape. It isn't as if he'd really been damaged like some of the patients I've sent you. Men who've been properly put through the mangle."
"Of course, if you put it like that. But pain's an odd thing. We know very little about it. You can't measure it. The difference in suffering between a woman having a baby and a man having a renal colic. And thank God, the body seems to forget fairly quickly. But this man of yours has been in real pain, Em. Don't think that just because nothing's been broken..."
"Quite, quite."
Bond had made a mistake, and he had suffered for it. In any case, M didn't like being lectured, even by one of the most famous doctors in the world, on how he should handle his patients. There had been a note of criticism in Sir James Maloney's voice. M said abruptly,
"Ever hear a man called Steinkrone? Dr. Peter Steinkrone?"
"No, who's he?"
"American doctor. I've written a book my Washington people sent over for our library. This man talks about how much punishment the human body can put up with. Gives a list of the bits of the body an average man can do without. Matter of fact, I copied it out for future reference. Care to hear the list?"
M dug into his coat pocket and put some letters and scraps of paper on the desk in front of him. With his left hand he selected a piece of paper and unfolded it. He wasn't put out by the silence on the other end of the line.
"Hello, Sir James? Well, here they are. gallbladder, spleen, tonsils, appendix. One of his two kidneys, one of his two lungs, two of his 4 or 5 quarts of blood, 2/5 of his liver, most of his stomach, 4 of his 23 feet of intestines, and 1/2 of his brain.
M paused. When the silence continued at the other end, he said,
"Any comments, Sir James?"
There was a reluctant grunt at the other end of the telephone.
"I wonder he didn't add an arm and a leg, or all of them. I don't see quite what you're trying to prove."
M gave a curt laugh.
"I'm not trying to prove anything, Sir James. It just struck me as an interesting list. All I'm trying to say is that my man seems to have got off pretty lightly compared with that sort of punishment. But—"
M relented.
"Don't let's argue about it,"
he said in a milder voice.
"As a matter of fact, I did have it in mind to let him have a bit of a breather. Something's come up in Jamaica."
M glanced at the streaming windows.
"It'll be more of a rest cure than anything. Two of my people, a man and a girl, have gone off together. Or that's what it looks like. Our friend can have a spell at being an inquiry agent. In the sunshine, too. How's that?"
"Just the ticket. I wouldn't mind the job myself on a day like this."
But Sir James Maloney was determined to get his message through. He persisted mildly.
"Don't think I want to interfere, M, but there are limits to a man's courage. I know you have to treat these men as if they were expendable, but presumably you don't want them to crack at the wrong moment. This one I've had here is tough. I'd say you'll get plenty more work out of him, but you know what Moran has to say about courage in that book of his?"
"Don't recall."
"He says that courage is a capital sum reduced by expenditure. I agree with him. All I'm trying to say is that this particular man seems to have been spending pretty hard since before the war. I wouldn't say he's overdrawn, not yet, but there are limits."
"Just so."
M decided that was quite enough of that. Nowadays, softness was everywhere.
"That's why I'm sending him abroad. Holiday in Jamaica. Don't worry, Sir James, I'll take care of him. By the way, did you ever discover what the stuff was that Russian woman put into him?"
"Got the answer yesterday."
Sir James Maloney also was glad the subject had been changed. The old man was as raw as the weather. Was there any chance that he had got his message across into what he described to himself as M's thick skull?
"Taken us 3 months. It was a bright chap at the School of Tropical Medicine who came up with it. The drug was fugu poison. The Japanese use it for committing suicide. It comes from the 6 organs of the Japanese globefish. Trust the Russians to use something no one's ever heard of. They might just as well have used curare. It has much the same effect, paralysis of the central nervous system. Fugu's scientific name is tetrodotoxin. It's terrible stuff and very quick. One shot of it, like your man got, and in a matter of seconds, the motor and respiratory muscles are paralyzed. At first the chap sees double, and then he can't keep his eyes open. Next he can't swallow. His head falls, and he can't raise it. Dies of respiratory paralysis."
"Lucky he got away with it."
"Miracle. Thanks entirely to that Frenchman who was with him. Got your man on the floor and gave him artificial respiration as if he was drowning. Somehow kept his lungs going until the doctor came. Luckily the doctor had worked in South America, diagnosed curare, and treated him accordingly. But it was a chance in a million. By the same token, what happened to the Russian woman?"
M said shortly.
"Oh, she died. Well, many thanks, Sir James, and don't worry about your patient. I'll see he has an easy time of it. Goodbye."
M hung up. His face was cold and blank. He pulled over the signal fire and went quickly through it. On some of the signals he scribbled a comment. Occasionally he made a brief telephone call to one of the sections. When he had finished, he tossed the pile into his out-basket and reached for his pipe and the tobacco jar made out of the base of a 14-pounder shell. Nothing remained in front of him except a buff folder marked with the top-secret red star. Across the centre of the folder was written in block capitals, "Caribbean Station," and underneath, in italics, "Strangways and True Blood." A light winked on the intercom. M pressed down the switch.
"Yes?"
"007's here, sir."
"Send him in, and tell the armourer to come up in 5 minutes."
M sat back. He put his pipe in his mouth and set a match to it. Through the smoke he watched the door to his secretary's office. His eyes were very bright and watchful. James Bond came through the door and shut it behind him. He walked over to the chair across the desk from M and sat down.
"Morning, 007.
"Good morning, sir." There was silence in the room, except for the rasping of M's pipe. It seemed to be taking a lot of matches to get it going. In the background, the fingernails of the sleet slashed against the two broad windows. It was all just as Bond had remembered it, through the months of being shunted from hospital to hospital, the weeks of dreary convalescence, the hard work of getting his body back into shape. To him this represented stepping back into life. Sitting here in this room, opposite M, was the symbol of normality he had longed for. He looked across, through the smoke clouds, into the shrewd, grey eyes. They were watching him. What was coming? A post-mortem on the shambles which had been his last case? A curt relegation to one of the home sections for a spell of desk work? Or some splendid new assignment M had been keeping on ice while waiting for Bond to get back to duty? M threw the box of matches down on the red leather desk. He leant back and clasped his hands behind his head.
"How do you feel? Glad to be back?"
"Very glad, sir. And I feel fine."
"Any final thoughts about your last case? Haven't bothered you with it till you got well. You heard I ordered an inquiry. I believe the Chief of Staff took some evidence from you. Anything to add?"
M's voice was businesslike, cold. Bond didn't like it. Something unpleasant was coming. He said, "No, sir. It was a mess. I blame myself for letting that woman get me. Shouldn't have happened." M took his hands from behind his neck and slowly leant forward and placed them flat on the desk in front of him. His eyes were hard.
"Just so."
The voice was velvet. Dangerous.
"Your gun got stuck, if I recall. This Beretta of yours with the silencer. Something wrong there, 007. Can't afford that sort of mistake if you're to carry a 00 number. Would you prefer to drop it and go back to normal duties?"
Bond stiffened. His eyes looked resentfully into M's. The license to kill for the Secret Service, the 00 prefix, was a great honour. It had been earned hardly. It brought Bond the only assignments he enjoyed. The dangerous ones. "No, I wouldn't, sir."
"Then we'll have to change your equipment. That was one of the findings of the Court of Inquiry. I agree with it. Do you understand?"
Bond said obstinately, "I'm used to that gun, sir. I like working with it. What happened could have happened to anyone, with any kind of gun."
"I don't agree. Nor did the Court of Inquiry. So that's final. The only question is what you're to use instead."
M bent forward to the intercom.
"Is the armourer there? Send him in."
M sat back.
"You may not know it, 007, but Major Boothroyd's the greatest small-arms expert in the world. He wouldn't be here if he wasn't. We'll hear what he has to say."
The door opened. A short, slim man with sandy hair came in and walked over to the desk and stood beside Bond's chair. Bond looked up into his face. He hadn't often seen the man before, but he remembered the very wide-apart, clear grey eyes that never seemed to flicker. With a non-committal glance down at Bond, the man stood relaxed, looking across at M. He said,
"Good morning, sir,"
in a flat, unemotional voice.
"Morning, Armourer. Now I want to ask you some questions."
M's voice was casual.
"First of all, what do you think of the Beretta, the .25?
"Lady's gun, sir." M raised ironic eyebrows at Bond. Bond smiled thinly.
"Really? And why do you say that?"
"No stopping power, sir. But it's easy to operate. A bit fancy-looking, too, if you know what I mean, sir. Appeals to the ladies."
"How would it be with a silencer?"
"Still less stopping power, sir. And I don't like silencers. They're heavy and get stuck in your clothing when you're in a hurry. I wouldn't recommend anyone to try a combination like that, sir. Not if they were meaning business." M said pleasantly to Bond.
"Any comment, 007?
Bond shrugged his shoulders. "I don't agree. I've used the .25 Beretta for 15 years. Never had a stoppage, and I haven't missed with it yet. Not a bad record for a gun. It just happens that I'm used to it, and I can point it straight. I've used bigger guns when I've had to, the .45 Colt, with a long barrel, for instance. But for close-up work and concealment, I like the Beretta." Bond paused. He felt he should give way somewhere. "I'd agree about the silencer, sir. They're a nuisance, but sometimes you have to use them."
"We've seen what happens when you do," said M, dryly. "And as for changing your gun, it's only a question of practice. You'll soon get the feel of a new one."
M allowed a trace of sympathy to enter his voice.
"Sorry, 007, but I've decided. Just stand up a moment. I want the armourer to get a look at your build."
Bond stood up and faced the other man. There was no warmth in the two pairs of eyes. Bond's showed irritation. Major Boothroyd's were indifferent, clinical. He walked round Bond. He said, "Excuse me."
and felt Bond's biceps and forearms. He came back in front of him and said, "Might I see your gun?" Bond's hand went slowly into his coat. He handed over the taped Beretta with a sawn barrel. Boothroyd examined the gun and weighed it in his hand. He put it down on the desk. "And your holster?" Bond took off his coat and slipped off the chamois leather holster and harness. He put his coat on again. With a glance at the lips of the holster, perhaps to see if they showed traces of snagging, Boothroyd tossed the holster down beside the gun with a motion that sneered. He looked across at M. "I think we can do better than this, sir." It was the sort of voice Bond's first expensive tailor had used. Bond sat down. He just stopped himself, gazing rudely at the ceiling. Instead, he looked impassively across at M.
"Well, armourer, what do you recommend?"
Major Boothroyd put on the expert's voice.
"As a matter of fact, sir," he said modestly, "I've just been testing most of the small automatics. 5,000 rounds each at 25 yards. Of all of them, I choose the Walter PPK 7.65mm. It only came fourth after the Japanese M14, the Russian Tokarev, and the Sauer M38. But I like its light trigger pull, and the extension spur of the magazine gives a grip that should suit 007. It's a real stopping gun. Of course, it's about .32 caliber as compared with the Beretta's .25, but I wouldn't recommend anything lighter, and you can get ammunition for the Walter anywhere in the world. That gives it an edge on the Japanese and the Russian guns." M turned to Bond.
"Any comments?"
"It's a good gun, sir," Bond admitted. "Bit more bulky than the Beretta. How does the armourer suggest I carry it?"
"Burns Martin triple draw holster," said Major Boothroyd succinctly. "Best worn inside the trouser band to the left, but it's all right below the shoulder. Stiff saddle leather. Holds the gun in with a spring. Should make for a quicker draw than that." He gestured towards the desk. 3/5 of a second to hit a man at 20 feet will be about right.
"That's settled, then."
M's voice was final.
"And what about something bigger?"
"There's only one gun for that, sir," said Major Boothroyd stolidly. "Smith & Wesson Centennial Airweight. Revolver. .38 caliber. Hammerless, so it won't catch in clothing. Overall length of 6.5 inches, and it only weighs 13 ounces. To keep down the weight, the cylinder holds only 5 cartridges. But by the time they're gone," Major Boothroyd allowed himself a wintry smile, "someone's been killed. Fires the .38 S&W Special. Very accurate cartridge indeed. With standard loading, it has a muzzle velocity of 860 feet per second and muzzle energy of 260 foot-pounds. There are various barrel lengths, 3.5 inch, 5 inch.
"All right, all right."
M's voice was testy.
"Take it as read. If you say it's the best, I'll believe you. So it's the Walter and the Smith & Wesson. Send up one of each to 007, with the harness, and arrange for him to fire them in, starting today. He's got to be an expert in a week, all right? Then thank you very much, armourer. I won't detain you."
"Thank you, sir," said Major Boothroyd. He turned and marched stiffly out of the room. There was a moment's silence. The sleet tore at the windows. M swiveled his chair and watched the streaming panes. Bond took the opportunity to glance at his watch. 10 o'clock. His eyes slid to the gun and holster on the desk. He thought of his 15 years' marriage to the ugly bit of metal. He remembered the times its single word had saved his life, and the times when its threat alone had been enough. He thought of the days when he had literally dressed to kill, when he had dismantled the gun and oiled it and packed the bullets carefully into the spring-loaded magazine and tried the action once or twice, pumping the cartridges out onto the bedspread in some hotel bedroom somewhere around the world. Then the last wipe of a dry rag, and the gun into the little holster, and a pause in front of the mirror to see that nothing showed. And then out of the door, and on his way to the rendezvous that was to end with either darkness or light. How many times had it saved his life? How many death sentences had it signed? Bond felt unreasonably sad. How could one have such ties with an inanimate object, an ugly one at that, and, he had to admit it, with a weapon that was not in the same class as the ones chosen by the armourer? But he had the ties, and M was going to cut them. M swiveled back to face him.
"Sorry, James,"
he said, and there was no sympathy in his voice.
"I know how you like that bit of iron, but I'm afraid it's got to go. Never give a weapon a second chance, any more than a man. I can't afford to gamble with the 00 section. They've got to be properly equipped, you understand that? A gun's more important than a hand or a foot in your job."
Bond smiled thinly. "I know, sir. I shan't argue. I'm just sorry to see it go."
All right, then, we'll say no more about it. Now, I've got some more news for you. There's a job come up in Jamaica, personnel problem. Well, that's what it looks like, a routine investigation and report. The sunshine'll do you good, and you can practice your new guns on the turtles, or whatever they have down there. You could do with a bit of a holiday. Like to take it on?
Bond thought, he's got it in for me over the last job. Feels I let him down. Won't trust me with anything tough. Wants to see. Oh, well. He said, sounds rather like the soft life, sir. I've had almost too much of that lately, but if it's got to be done, if you say so, sir.
Yes,
said M.
I say so.
Chapter 3. Holiday Task. It was getting dark. Outside, the weather was thickening. M reached over and switched on the green-shaded desk light. The centre of the room became a warm yellow pool in which the leather top of the desk glowed blood red. M pulled the thick file towards him. Bond noticed it for the first time. He read the reverse lettering without difficulty. What had Strangways been up to? Who was Trueblood? M pressed a button on his desk.
I'll get the Chief of Staff in on this, he said. I know the bones of the case, but he can fill in the flesh. It's a drab little story, I'm afraid.
The Chief of Staff came in. He was a colonel in the sappers, a man of about Bond's age, but his hair was prematurely grey at the temples from the endless grind of work and responsibility. He was saved from a nervous breakdown by physical toughness and a sense of humour. He was Bond's best friend at headquarters. They smiled at each other.
Bring up a chair, Chief of Staff. I've given 007 the Strangways case. Got to get the mess cleared up before we make a new appointment there. 007 can be acting head of station in the meantime. I want him to leave in a week. Would you fix that with the Colonial Office and the Governor? Now let's go over the case.
He turned to Bond.
I think you knew Strangways, 007. See, you worked with him on that treasure business about 5 years ago. What did you think of him?
Good man, sir. Bit highly strung. I'd have thought he'd have been relieved by now. 5 years is a long time in the tropics. M ignored the comment.
And his number two, this girl Trueblood, Mary Trueblood, ever come across her?
No, sir.
I see she's got a good record. Chief Officer WRNS, and then came to us. Nothing against her on her confidential record. Good looker, to judge from her photographs. That would probably explain it. Would you say Strangways was a bit of a womanizer?
Could have been, said Bond carefully, not wanting to say anything against Strangways, but remembering the dashing good looks. But what's happened to them, sir?
That's what we want to find out, said M. They've gone, vanished into thin air. Both went on the same evening, about 3 weeks ago. Left Strangways's bungalow burned to the ground, radio, code books, files. Nothing left but a few charred scraps. The girl left all her things intact. Must have taken only what she stood up in. Even her passport was in her room. But it would have been easy for Strangways to cook up two passports. He had plenty of blanks. He was passport control officer for the island. Any number of planes they could have taken, to Florida or South America or one of the other islands in his area. Police are still checking the passenger lists. Nothing's come up yet, but they could always have gone to ground for a day or two and then done a bunk, dyed the girl's hair and so forth. Airport security doesn't amount to much in that part of the world. Isn't that so, Chief of Staff?
Yes, sir.
The Chief of Staff sounded dubious.
But I still can't understand that last radio contact.
He turned to Bond.
You see, they began to make their routine contact at 18:30 Jamaican time. Someone, radio security thinks it was the girl, acknowledged our WWW and then went off the air. We tried to regain contact, but there was obviously something fishy and we broke off. No answer to the blue call or to the red, so that was that. Next day, Section 3 sent 258 down from Washington. By that time, the police had taken over and the governor had already made up his mind and was trying to get the case hushed up. It all seemed pretty obvious to him. Strangways has had occasional girl trouble down there. Can't blame the chap myself. It's a quiet station. Not much to occupy his time. The governor jumped to the obvious conclusions. So, of course, did the local police. Sex and machete fights are about all they understand. 258 spent a week down there and couldn't turn up a scrap of contrary evidence. He reported accordingly, and we sent him back to Washington. Since then, the police have been scraping around rather ineffectually and getting nowhere.
The Chief of Staff paused.
He looked apologetically at M.
"I know you're inclined to agree with the Governor, sir, but that radio contact sticks in my throat. I just can't see where it fits into the runaway couple picture. And Strangways's friends at the club say he was perfectly normal, left in the middle of a rubber of bridge, always did when he was getting close to his deadline. Said he'd be back in 20 minutes, ordered drinks all round, again just as he always did, and left the club dead on 6:15, exactly to schedule. Then he vanished into thin air. Even left his car in front of the club. Now, why should he set the rest of his bridge for looking for him if he wanted to skip with the girl? Why not leave in the morning, or better still, late at night, after they'd made their radio call and tidied up their lives? It just doesn't make sense to me."
M grunted noncommittally.
"People in love do stupid things," he said gruffly. "Act like lunatics sometimes. And anyway, what other explanation is there? Absolutely no trace of foul play, no reason for it that anyone can see. It's a quiet station down there. Same routines every month. An occasional communist trying to get into the island from Cuba. Crooks from England thinking they can hide away just because Jamaica's so far from London. I don't suppose Strangways has had a big case since 007 was there."
He turned to Bond.
"On what you've heard, what do you think, 007? There's not much else to tell you."
Bond was definite. "I just can't see Strangways flying off the handle like that, sir. I dare say he was having an affair with the girl, though I wouldn't have thought he was a man to mix business with pleasure. But the service was his whole life. He'd never have let it down. I can see him handing in his papers and the girl doing the same and then going off with her after you'd sent out reliefs. But I don't believe it was in him to leave us in the air like this. And from what you say of the girl, I'd say it would be much the same with her. Chief officers WRNS don't go out of their senses."
"Thank you, 007.
M's voice was controlled.
"These considerations had also crossed my mind. No one's been jumping to conclusions without weighing all the possibilities. Perhaps you can suggest another solution."
M sat back and waited. He reached for his pipe and began filling it. The case bored him. He didn't like personnel problems, least of all messy ones like this. There were plenty of other worries waiting to be coped with round the world. It was only to give Bond the pretense of a job, mixed with a good rest, that he had decided to send him out to Jamaica to close the case. He put the pipe in his mouth and reached for the matches.
"Well?"
Bond wasn't going to be put off his stride. He had liked Strangways, and he was impressed by the points the Chief of Staff had made. He said, "Well, sir, for instance, what was the last case Strangways was working on? Had he reported anything, or was there anything Section 3 had asked him to look into? Anything at all in the last few months?"
"Nothing whatsoever."
M was definite. He took the pipe out of his mouth and cocked it at the Chief of Staff.
"Right?" "Right, sir,"
said the Chief of Staff.
"Only that damned business about the birds."
"Oh, that," said M contemptuously. "Some rot from the zoo or somebody. Got wished on us by the Colonial Office about 6 weeks ago, wasn't it?"
"That's right, sir. But it wasn't the zoo. It was some people in America called the Audubon Society. They protect rare birds from extinction or something like that. Got on to our ambassador in Washington, and the F.O. passed the buck to the Colonial Office. They shoved it on to us. Seems these bird people are pretty powerful in America. They even got an atom-bombing range shifted on the West Coast because it interfered with some birds' nests."
M snorted.
"Damn thing called a whooping crane. Read about it in the papers."
Bond persisted. "Could you tell me about it, sir? What did the Audubon people want us to do?" M waved his pipe impatiently. He picked up the Strangways file and tossed it down in front of the Chief of Staff.
"You tell him, Chief of Staff," he said wearily. "It's all in there."
The Chief of Staff took the file and riffled through the pages towards the back. He found what he wanted and bent the file in half. There was silence in the room while he ran his eye over 3 pages of typescript, which Bond could see were headed with the blue and white cipher of the Colonial Office. Bonds sat quietly, trying not to feel M's coiled impatience radiating across the desk. The Chief of Staff slapped the file shut. He said,
"Well, this is the story as we passed it to Strangways on January the 20th. He acknowledged receipt, but after that we heard nothing from him."
The Chief of Staff sat back in his chair. He looked at Bond.
"It seems there's a bird called a roseate spoonbill. There's a coloured photograph of it in here. Looks like a sort of pink stalk with an ugly flat bill which it uses for digging for food in the mud. Not many years ago these birds were dying out. Just before the war there were only a few hundred left in the world, mostly in Florida and thereabouts. Then somebody reported a colony of them on an island called Crab Key between Jamaica and Cuba. It's British territory, a dependency of Jamaica. It used to be a guano island, but the quality of the guano was too low for the cost of digging it. When the birds were found there, it had been uninhabited for about 50 years. The Audubon people went there and ended up by leasing a corner as a sanctuary for these spoonbills. Put two wardens in charge and persuaded the airlines to stop flying over the island and disturbing the birds. The birds flourished, and at the last count there were about 5,000 of them on the island. Then came the war. The price of guano went up, and some bright chap had the idea of buying the island and starting to work it again. He negotiated with the Jamaican government and bought the place for £10,000, with the condition that he didn't disturb the lease of the sanctuary. That was in 1943. Well, this man imported plenty of cheap labour and soon had the place working at a profit, and it's gone on making a profit until recently. Then the price of guano took a dip, and it's thought that he must be having a hard time making both ends meet.
Who is this man?
Chinaman. Or rather, half Chinese and half German. Got a daft name. Calls himself Dr. No. Dr. Julius No.
No? Spelt like yes?
That's right.
Any facts about him?
Nothing except that he keeps very much to himself. Hasn't been seen since he made his deal with the Jamaican government. And there's no traffic with the island. It's his, and he keeps it private. Says he doesn't want people disturbing the guano birds who turn out his guano. Seems reasonable. Well, nothing happened until just before Christmas, when one of the Audubon wardens, a Barbadian, a good solid chap apparently, arrived on the north shore of Jamaica in a canoe. He was very sick. He was terribly burned. Died in a few days. Before he died, he told some crazy story about their camp having been attacked by a dragon with flames coming out of its mouth. This dragon had killed his pal and burned up the camp and gone roaring off into the bird sanctuary, belching fire among the birds and scaring them off to God knows where. He had been badly burned, but he'd escaped to the coast and stolen a canoe and sailed all one night to Jamaica. Poor chap was obviously off his rocker. And that was that, except that a routine report had to be sent off to the Audubon Society, and they weren't satisfied. Sent down two of their big brass in a beach craft from Miami to investigate. There's an airstrip on the island. This Chinaman's got a Grumman amphibian for bringing in supplies.
M. interjected sourly.
All these people seem to have a hell of a lot of money to throw about on their damned birds.
Bond and the Chief of Staff exchanged smiles. M. had been trying for years to get the Treasury to give him an Oster for the Caribbean station. The Chief of Staff continued.
And the Beechcraft crashed on landing and killed the two Audubon men. Well, that aroused these bird people to a fury. They got a corvette from the U.S. training squadron in the Caribbean to make a call on Dr. No. That's how powerful these people are. Seems they've got quite a lobby in Washington. The captain of the corvette reported that he was received very civilly by Dr. No, but was kept well away from the guano workings. He was taken to an airstrip and examined the remains of the plane. Smashed to pieces, but nothing suspicious. Came into land too fast, probably. The bodies of the two men and the pilot had been reverently embalmed and packed in handsome coffins, which were handed over with quite a ceremony. The captain was very impressed by Dr. No's courtesy. He asked to see the warden's camp, and he was taken out there and shown the remains of it. Dr. No's theory was that the two men had gone mad because of the heat and the loneliness, or at any rate that one of them had gone mad and burned down the camp with the other inside it. This seemed possible to the captain when he'd seen what a godforsaken bit of marsh the men had been living in for 10 years or more. But there was nothing else to see, and he was politely steered back to his ship and sailed away.
The Chief of Staff spread his hands.
And that's the lot, except that the captain reported that he saw only a handful of roseate spoonbills. When his report got back to the Audubon Society, it was apparently the loss of their blasted birds that infuriated these people most of all, and ever since then they've been nagging at us to have an inquiry into the whole business. Of course, nobody at the Colonial Office or in Jamaica is in the least interested, so in the end the whole fairy story was dumped in our lap.
The Chief of Staff shrugged his shoulders with finality.
And that's how this pile of bumph,
he waved the file,
or at any rate the guts of it, got landed on Strangways.
M. looked morosely at Bond.
See what I mean, 007? Just the sort of mare's nest these old women societies are always stirring up. People start preserving something, churches, old houses, decaying pictures, birds, and there's always a hullabaloo of some sort. The trouble is these sort of people get really worked up about their damned birds, or whatever it is. They get the politicians involved, and somehow they all seem to have stacks of money. God knows where it comes from. Other old women, I suppose. And then there comes a point when someone has to do something to keep them quiet, like this case.
It gets shunted off to me because the place is British territory. At the same time, it's private land. Nobody wants to interfere officially. So I'm supposed to do what? Send a submarine to the island? For what? To find out what's happened to a covey of pink storks?
M snorted.
Anyway, you asked about Strangways's last case, and that's it.
M leant forward belligerently.
Any questions? I've got a busy day ahead.
Bond grinned. He couldn't help it. M's occasional outbursts of rage were so splendid, and nothing set him going so well as any attempt to waste the time and energies and slim funds of the Secret Service. Bond got to his feet. "Perhaps if I could have the file, sir," he said placatingly. "It just strikes me that four people seem to have died more or less because of these birds. Perhaps two more did, Strangways and the True Blood girl.
I agree it sounds ridiculous, but we've got nothing else to go on." Take it," said M impatiently, "and hurry up and get your holiday over. You may not have noticed it, but the rest of the world happens to be in a bit of a mess."
Bond reached across and picked up the file. He also made to pick up his Beretta and the holster.
"No," said M sharply. "Leave that, and mind you've got the hang of the other two guns by the time I see you again."
Bond looked across into M's eyes. For the first time in his life, he hated the man. He knew perfectly well why M was being tough and mean. It was deferred punishment for having nearly got killed on his last job, plus getting away from the filthy weather into the sunshine. M couldn't bear his men to have an easy time. In a way, Bond felt sure he was being sent on this cushy assignment to humiliate him. The old bastard. With the anger boiling up inside him like cat's fur, Bond said, "I'll see to it, sir," and turned and walked out of the room. Chapter 4. Reception Committee. The 68 tons dead weight of the superconstellation hurled high above the green and brown checkerboard of Cuba, and with only another 100 miles to go, started its slow declining flight towards Jamaica. Bond watched the big green turtle-backed island grow on the horizon, and the water below him turn from the dark blue of the Cuba deep to the azure and milk of the inshore shoals. Then they were over the north shore, over its rash of millionaire hotels, and crossing the high mountains of the interior. The scattered dice of small holdings showed on the slopes and in clearings in the jungle, and the setting sun flashed gold on the bright worms of tumbling rivers and streams. Shemaka, the Arawak Indians had called it, the land of hills and rivers. Bond's heart lifted with the beauty of one of the most fertile islands in the world. The other side of the mountains was in deep violet shadow. Lights were already twinkling in the foothills and spangling the streets of Kingston. But beyond, the far arm of the harbour and the airport were still touched with the sun, against which the Port Royal lighthouse blinked ineffectually. Now the constellation was getting its nose down into a wide sweep beyond the harbour. There was a slight thump as the tricycle landing gear extended under the aircraft and locked into position, and a shrill hydraulic whine as the brake flaps slid out of the trailing edge of the wings. Slowly the great aircraft turned in again towards the land, and for a moment the setting sun poured gold into the cabin. Then the plane had dipped below the level of the Blue Mountains and was skimming down towards the single north-south runway. There was a glimpse of a road and telephone wires. Then the concrete, scarred with black skid marks, was under the belly of the plane, and there was the soft double thump of a perfect landing and the roar of reversing props as they taxied in towards the low white airport buildings. The sticky fingers of the tropics brushed Bond's face as he left the aircraft and walked over to Health and Immigration. He knew that by the time he had got through customs he would be sweating. He didn't mind. After the rasping cold of London, the stuffy velvet heat was easily bearable. Bond's passport described him as import and export merchant.
"What company, sir?"
"Universal Export.
Are you here on business or pleasure, sir?"
"Pleasure. I hope you enjoy your stay, sir." The Negro immigration officer handed Bond his passport with indifference. "Thank you." Bond walked out into the customs hall. At once he saw the tall, brown-skinned man against the barrier. He was wearing the same old faded blue shirt and probably the same khaki twill trousers he had been wearing when Bond first met him 5 years before.
"Quarrel!"
From behind the barrier the Cayman Islander gave a broad grin. He lifted his right forearm across his eyes in the old salute of the West Indians.
"How you, Captain?"
he called delightedly.
"I'm fine," said Bond. "Just wait till I get my bag through. Got the car?"
"Sure, Captain." The customs officer, who, like most men from the waterfront, knew Quarrel, chalked Bond's bag without opening it, and Bond picked it up and went out through the barrier. Quarrel took it from him and held out his right hand. Bond took the warm, dry, calloused paw and looked into the dark grey eyes that showed descent from a Cromwellian soldier or a pirate of Morgan's time. "You haven't changed, Quarrel," he said affectionately. "How's the turtle fishing?"
"Not so bad, Captain, and not so good. Much the same as always."
He looked critically at Bond.
"You been sick or something?"
Bond was surprised. "As a matter of fact, I have, but I've been fit for weeks. What made you say that?" Quarrel was embarrassed.
"Sorry, Captain," he said, thinking he might have offended Bond. "There's some pain lines in your face since the last time."
"Oh, well," said Bond. "It was nothing much, but I could do with a spell of your training. I'm not as fit as I ought to be."
"Shorting, Captain."
They were moving towards the exit when there came the sharp crack and flash of a press camera. A pretty Chinese girl in Jamaican dress was lowering her speed graphic. She came up to them. She said with synthetic charm, "Thank you, gentlemen. I am from the Daily Gleaner." She glanced down at a list in her hand. "Mr. Bond, isn't it? And how long will you be with us, Mr. Bond?" Bond was off hand. This was a bad start.
"In transit," he said shortly. "I think you'll find there were more interesting people on the plane."
"Oh, no, I'm sure not, Mr. Bond. You look very important. And what hotel will you be staying at?"
"Damn," thought Bond. He said, "Myrtle Bank," and moved on.
"Thank you, Mr. Bond," said the tinkling voice. "I hope you'll enjoy—"
They were outside.
As they walked towards the parking place, Bond said, "Ever seen that girl at the airport before?" Quarrel reflected.
"Reckon not, Captain, but the Gleaner have plenty camera gals."
Bond was vaguely worried. There was no earthly reason why his picture should be wanted by the press. It was 5 years since his last adventures on the island, and anyway his name had been kept out of the papers. They got to the car. It was a black Sunbeam Alpine. Bond looked sharply at it and then at the number plate. Strangways's car. What the hell?
"Where did you get this, Quarrel?"
"ADC tell me for to take him, Captain. Him say hit the only spare car they have. Why, Captain, him no good?"
"Oh, it's all right, Quarrel," said Bond resignedly. "Come on, let's get going."
Bond got into the passenger seat. It was entirely his fault. He might have guessed at the chance of getting this car. But it would certainly put the finger on him, and on what he was doing in Jamaica, if anyone happened to be interested. They moved off down the long, cactus-fringed road towards the distant lights of Kingston. Normally, Bond would have sat and enjoyed the beauty of it all, the steady zing of the crickets, the rush of warm, scented air, the ceiling of stars, the necklace of yellow lights shimmering across the harbour. But now he was cursing his carelessness and knowing what he shouldn't have done. What he had done was to send one signal through the Colonial Office to the Governor. In it he had first asked that the ADC should get Quarrel over from the Cayman Islands for an indefinite period on a salary of £10 a week. Quarrel had been with Bond on his last adventure in Jamaica. He was an invaluable handyman, with all the fine seaman's qualities of the Cayman Islander. And he was a passport into the lower strata of coloured life, which would otherwise be closed to Bond. Everybody loved him, and he was a splendid companion. Bond knew that Quarrel was vital if he was to get anywhere on the Strangways case, whether it was a case or just a scandal. Then Bond had asked for a single room and shower at the Blue Hills Hotel, for the loan of a car and for Quarrel to meet him with the car at the airport. Most of this had been wrong. In particular, Bond should have taken a taxi to his hotel and made contact with Quarrel later. Then he would have seen the car and had a chance to change it. As it was, reflected Bond, he might just as well have advertised his visit and its purpose in the Gleaner. He sighed. It was the mistakes one made at the beginning of a case that were the worst. They were the irretrievable ones, the ones that got you off on the wrong foot, that gave the enemy the first game. But was there an enemy? Wasn't he being over-cautious? On an impulse, Bond turned in his seat. 100 yards behind were 2 dim sidelights. Most Jamaicans drive with their headlights full on. Bond turned back. He said, "Quarrel, at the end of the Palisados, where the left fork goes to Kingston and right to Morant, I want you to turn quickly down the Morant Road and stop at once and turn your lights off. Right? And now go like hell."
"Okay, Captain."
Quarrel's voice sounded pleased. He put his foot down to the floorboards.
The little car gave a deep growl and tore off down the white road. Now they were at the end of the straight. The car skidded round the curve where the corner of the harbour bit into the land. Another 500 yards and they would be at the intersection. Bond looked back. There was no sign of the other car. Here was the signpost. Quarrel did a racing change and hurled the car round on a tight lock. He pulled in to the side and doused his lights. Bond turned and waited. At once he heard the roar of a big car at speed. Lights blazed on, looking for them. Then the car was passed and tearing on towards Kingston. Bond had time to notice that it was a big American-type taxicab and that there was no one in it but the driver. Then it was gone. The dust settled slowly. They sat for 10 minutes, saying nothing. Then Bond told Quarrel to turn the car and take the Kingston Road. He said, "I think that car was interested in us, Quarrel. You don't drive an empty taxi back from the airport. It's an expensive run. Keep a watch out. He may find we've fooled him and be waiting for us."
"Sure thing, Captain," said Quarrel happily.
This was just the sort of life he had hoped for when he got Bond's message. They came into the stream of Kingston traffic, buses, cars, horse-drawn carts, pannier-laden donkeys down from the hills, and the hand-drawn barrows selling violent coloured drinks. In the crush it was impossible to say if they were being followed. They turned off to the right and up towards the hills. There were many cars behind them. Any one of them could have been the American taxi. They drove for a quarter of an hour up to Halfway Tree and then on to the Junction Road, the main road across the island. Soon there was a neon sign of a green palm tree and underneath Blue Hills, the hotel. They drove in and up the drive lined with neatly rounded bushes of bougainvillea. 100 yards higher up the road the black taxi waved the following drivers on and pulled in to the left. It made a U-turn in a break in the traffic and swept back down the hill towards Kingston. The Blue Hills was a comfortable old-fashioned hotel with modern trimmings. Bond was welcomed with deference because his reservation had been made by King's House. He was shown to a fine corner room with a balcony looking out over the distant sweep of Kingston Harbour. Thankfully, he took off his London clothes, now moist with perspiration, and went into the glass-fronted shower and turned the cold water full on, and stood under it for 5 minutes, during which he washed his hair to remove the last dirt of big city life. Then he pulled on a pair of Sea Island cotton shorts and, with sensual pleasure at the warm, soft air on his nakedness, unpacked his things and rang for the waiter. Bond ordered a double gin and tonic and one whole green lime. When the drink came, he cut the lime in half, dropped the 2 squeezed halves into the long glass, almost filled the glass with ice cubes, and then poured in the tonic. He took the drink out onto the balcony and sat and looked out across the spectacular view. He thought how wonderful it was to be away from headquarters, and from London, and from hospitals, and to be here, at this moment, doing what he was doing and knowing, as all his senses told him, that he was on a good, tough case again. He sat for a while, luxuriously, letting the gin relax him. He ordered another and drank it down. It was 7:15. He had arranged for Quarrel to pick him up at 7:30. They were going to have dinner together. Bond had asked Quarrel to suggest a place. After a moment of embarrassment, Quarrel had said that whenever he wanted to enjoy himself in Kingston, he went to a waterfront night spot called the Joy Boat.
"Hit no great shakes, Captain," he had said apologetically, "but the food and drinks and music is good, and I got a good friend there. Him owns the joint. They calls him Pussfella, seeing how him once fought with a big hoctopus."
Bond smiled to himself at the way Quarrel, like most West Indians, added an H where it wasn't needed and took it off when it was. He went into his room and dressed in his old dark blue tropical worsted suit, a sleeveless white cotton shirt and a black knitted tie, looked in the glass to see that the Walter didn't show under his armpit, and went down and out to where the car was waiting. They swooped down quietly through the soft, singing dusk into Kingston, and turned to the left along the harbour side. They passed 1 or 2 smart restaurants and nightclubs, from which came the throb and twang of calypso music. There was a stretch of private houses that dwindled into a poor-class shopping centre and then into shacks. Then, where the road curved away from the sea, there was a blaze of golden neon in the shape of a Spanish galleon above green lettering that said, "The Joy Boat." They pulled into a parking place, and Bond followed Quarrel through the gate into a small garden of palm trees growing out of lawn. At the end was the beach and the sea. Tables were dotted about under the palms, and in the centre was a small, deserted cement dance floor, to one side of which a calypso trio in sequined scarlet shirts was softly improvising on "Take Her to Jamaica, Where the Rum Comes From." Only half the tables were filled, mostly by coloured people. There was a sprinkling of British and American sailors with their girls. An immensely fat negro in a smart white dinner jacket left one of the tables and came to meet them.
"Hi, Mr. Q. Long time no see. Nice table for two?"
"That's right, puss fella. Closer to the kitchen than the music."
The big man chuckled. He led them down towards the sea and placed them at a quiet table under a palm tree that grew out of the base of the restaurant building.
"Drinks, gemmum?"
Bond ordered his gin and tonic with a lime, and Quarrel a red stripe beer. They scanned the menu and both decided on broiled lobster, followed by a rare steak with native vegetables. The drinks came. The glasses were dripping with condensation. The small fact reminded Bond of other times in hot climates. A few yards away the sea lisped on the flat sand. The three-piece began playing Kitsch. Above them the palm fronds clashed softly in the night breeze. A gecko chuckled somewhere in the garden. Bond thought of the London he had left the day before. He said, "I like this place, Quarrel." Quarrel was pleased.
"Him a good friend of mine, that puss fella. Him knows mostly what goes on in Kingston, case you got any questions, Captain. Him come from the Caymans. Him and me once share a boat. Then him go off one day, catching boobies heggs at Crab Key. Went swimming to a rock for more heggs, and this big hoctopus get him. They mostly small fellas round here, but they come bigger at the crab, seeing how it's alongside the Cuba Deep, the deepest waters round these parts. Puss fella have himself a bad time with this animal. Bust one lung cutting hisself free. That scare him and him sell me his half of the boat and come to Kingston. That were for the war. Now him rich man, whilst I go horn fishing."
Quarrel chuckled at the quirk of fate. "Crab Key," said Bond. "What sort of a place is that?" Quarrel looked at him sharply.
"That a bad luck place now, Captain," he said shortly. "Chinee gemmum buy hit during the war, and bring in men and dig bird dirt. Don't let nobody land there, and don't let no one get off. We gives it a wide berth."
This book is continued on Disc 2.